Hey, Patrick, Timpone. I started looking into health matters, I think in the late 70s, and been doing radio shows and such on it for a very long time. You can imagine the amount and the number and the variety of different health products that I've been introduced to in, over 30 years now? Tremendous amount. And as you could have probably already figured out, the great majority of them are just, just something that people sell. We've come in contact and become aware of something not long ago called, it's a bio superfood, microalgae, that we're promoting and we make a commission on and help support our thing here. And it's really good. It's really cool. You can look on it on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com. Scroll down and you'll see BioAge, microalgae, BioAge, biofood. It's a mixture of these four different microalgae. And you can click on the link and we get a commission on a sale. But even before that, get yourself an ebook called Awakening the Genius Within. And read that and really get turned on to this whole process with Dr. Kiriak out of Russia. And I think you'll want to try it. And we're giving it to the animals around here and Patrick and really loving it. It'll get that brain popping and so many different things. It really takes this whole idea of let food be your medicine to a whole nother level because it is food. It's microalgae. Right on the front page, you'll see it. BioAge. BioAge right on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com.
We are listener-supported. One Radio Network.
Alrighty, here we go. Round two. We're broadcasting live every morning, 9 to 11 o'clock Central Time. That would be 10 to noon Eastern and 7 to 9 Pacific. Can't believe I figured that out all by myself tomorrow. Anxiety, looking at the mirror and learning stuff about ourselves. We'll also be talking about allergies, sinuses. Oops, just dropped my pen. With Dr. Grossman, if I don't fall off my chair here. And then also Marty, what's his last name? Get to the right calendar. He wrote the book called The Purposeful Primitive. Oh, now I can't even get in the calendar. You see, just when I need it, but that's okay. I'll get in. And he'll be here tomorrow at 10 o'clock Central Time. Got this Google calendar and I just go to click on it to get in it and it says, you can't do that. Why does it do that? I just don't know about computers. I'm glad I'm not depending on it to introduce our guest. We're going to talk to Kenneth Anderson. Kenneth is an interesting man. He's the founder and CEO of HAMS, Harm Reduction Network. He's also author of How to Change Your Drinking, A Harm Reduction Guide to Alcohol. Mr. Anderson, good morning.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for having me on your show this morning.
Well, it's quite our pleasure. Thank you. Harm Reduction Networks. It's so interesting because over the years, how many times have we heard Kenneth Anderson? Boy, the only way to stop drinking is cold turkey, right? The only way. You just can't do it anyway. Boy, you just got to just get in there and quit. So you don't think that that's the only way?
That's great for some people. It works for. The statistics from the NIAAA, the National Institute on Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse, which is the U.S. government, they published in their magazine Spectrum recently, and people can Google this, about 20% of people with alcohol dependence will go to either a 12-step treatment or to AA, and they will solve their problem that way, but that still leaves 80% that are unhelped by these more standard approaches.
80%? Well, Kenneth, why do you think it is? What do you think, and not to be critical of the other, the AAs and Al-Anons and all that, but what do you think it is in their model, spiritually or philosophically, that causes it, why it doesn't work?
Well, not everyone can make that quantum change of changing all at once, of going from, you know, being a very heavy drinker to quitting completely. It does work for a certain percentage. 20% is quite a large number. And so we wish them all well, everyone this works for. But the other people, they can benefit from a different approach that will encourage every positive change. That's what our program is all about, is encouraging every positive change. If you want to be a safer drinker, we say that's a good thing. If you want to cut back, that's good. And if you want to quit completely, we support that too, of course. But, you know, if you just say, well, I still want to drink and get intoxicated every night, but I decide to stop drinking and driving. You know, if you go to AA and say that, they will just, you know, not be very happy with you at all.
They'll say, get out of here.
But if you come to us and say that, we'll say, that's a good goal. That's better than not making any change at all. So harm reduction programs are programs that support small changes. They've had great successes. One example is needle exchange programs, you know. Sure, we would like you to quit heroin completely, but if you're not going to do that, you know, use clean needles, don't spread diseases.
Wow, boy, when you get away from the absolutes and the dogmatic positions, I assume that does people, just they must get their dander up.
Well, it does for some people, but because I wanted to learn a lot about harm reduction because nobody was really doing it for alcohol, at mm-hmm. least not as a free of charge group. There were some counselors that were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But since I wanted to really learn about this a lot, I volunteered for a couple of years doing needle exchange. And, you know, it really changed my attitude. And one reason I brought that up is many of my colleagues that work in needle exchange programs are also members of 12-step programs. They are members of Narcotics Anonymous very frequently. And they say, you know, when I was shooting heroin, these clean needles kept me alive. And then when I decided to quit, the 12-step program helped me to quit. So they don't see, you know, a contradiction there. And there really should not be a contradiction there.
I don't understand that. So your organization, Harm Reduction Network, and your book, How to Change Your Drinking, A Harm Reduction Guide to Alcohol, it also deals with drugs, other drugs.
Not very much.
Okay, mainly your organization is in alcohol, but you mentioned the needle exchange program. That's how you started in this whole genre.
That's how I trained, because that was the only real place to train.
Huh.
I mean, there are some really good books out there. I want to really recommend Pat Denning's book. It's called Over the Influence, and it's a harm reduction guide for drug users, and it's a great book, and it gave me lots of ideas to write this harm reduction book about alcohol. See, there were well-established harm reduction programs for drug users out there, and I used them as a model when I was writing this harm reduction book for alcohol.
What does harm reduction mean, really? What is the real definition of it?
Well, harm reduction includes anything that reduces harm. And, of course, that includes quitting completely. That includes successful abstinence. It includes cutting back. It includes being safer. There are many things that are harm reduction that we don't even think of with that term. When it comes to driving an automobile, we have laws now that say you need to use a seatbelt. The seatbelt is a harm reduction device. The alternative approach would be to say to everyone, you must stop driving completely, never drive again, and that's not very practical.
Is there a lot of fear? Are you a former drinker, or what's your current status?
I currently drink one night a week and abstain the rest of the time. I don't drink on a work night.
And then, mm-hmm. and was drinking a problem for you at one point in your life?
Yes, I used to drink to intoxication four nights out of the week. I would go into work hungover, do other stupid things like that, and it was not a good thing. And now I changed. I never drink on a work night. I drink one night a week, you know, before I have a day off. I drink at home. I don't leave the house. I stay very safe. And it's completely unproblematic.
That's interesting. That really blows apart that whole theory. So what would be your clinical definition then of an alcoholic? They say people that can't control themselves. Do you consider that you were under that pure definition of an alcoholic when you were drinking to destruction 4 or 5 nights a week?
Well, according to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, that's the official source book, yes, in those days I fit that criteria. And also according to that book, it's a lifelong disease that no one can ever change. But then again, when we start looking at the statistics that the NIAAA, which is the U.S. government agency, they tell us that 55% of people with alcohol dependence will resolve their problem on their own at some point in their lifetime without any specialized treatment or without going to AA. So the norm is actually to resolve the problem on your own. What we do with our harm reduction program is we try to give people some ideas and strategies to resolve the problem more quickly or to have fewer problems on the way to resolving their problems with alcohol. Or if they are in the 25% that does not resolve their problems, even this 25% makes improvements very often. Many of them make improvements. So we also offer ways for them to make improvements and have less problems attached with their alcohol use.
With Kenneth Anderson, founder and CEO of HAMS Harm Reduction Network. It is hamsnetwork.org, hamsnetwork.org. This is a lay-led, free of charge support group. And are these groups all over the country?
We have online groups. We have a live chat.
I'll be
that
done.
It's at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, so it's 8 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific. And we have people from all over the world that will participate in our live chat room. We also have an email support group where we have people from all over the world that will participate in this. As far as live meetings go, we still have just the one live meeting in Brooklyn, New York, because, well, we're still a pretty young group. We were only founded in 2007, and it takes some time to grow.
Well, these days, online's the same as being there almost.
Absolutely, and many people like online because it is so anonymous, and you know you don't know who the person is. You're not going to run into them in the grocery store.
What about that? Talk a bit about what people go through who are really struggling with drinking alcohol to excess. They must feel pretty rotten about themselves, huh?
Very often, you know, they have extremely negative self-images. And, you know, the more traditional program very often is not a good place to go because it just says, well, you're a terrible person for drinking and you have to stop because you're so terrible because you drink.
Does it really? I mean, I've never been to an AA meeting, but I want to criticize them. They've done a lot of great work. But is that the essence where they really say you just got to stop?
Well, you know, the first step is that you are powerless over alcohol, and then you need to find a higher power that will rescue you from your alcohol use. You need some external locus of control. So you need something outside yourself to rescue yourself. We, on the other hand, work more from the idea that people have many strengths inside, and they're not taking full advantage of them. And we try to bring out the strengths and, you know, exercise the strengths. You know, we say, you know, if you do one day of abstinence from alcohol, you are exercising your abstinence muscle. And every day that you exercise your abstinence muscle, it gets stronger. And you're more capable of doing abstinence. And, you know, we recommend people do not drink every day of the week. We don't have absolute rules. I mean, if someone drinks, you know, 3 glasses of wine every day, and they used to drink, you know, 3 bottles of wine every day, that's a great improvement, and we certainly support that. Usually most people find it better to have some days off during the week, so we say, you know, often this works, but of course we support every positive change that anyone can make.
Well, it just sounds like a reasonable way to do it. I was reading something the other day. I think I have it here. By the way, Kenneth Anderson is with us. If you care to join us, 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. I may have it on another sheet of paper, but, oh, here it is, yeah. Check this out. This is pretty interesting. 10 years after drugs are decriminalized in Portugal, rates of marijuana usage in people over 15 in the EU, about 10%, compare this to 40% of people over 12 who regularly smoke pot in the U.S., a country with some of the most punitive drug laws in the developed world. Drug use of all kinds has declined in Portugal. Lifetime use among 7th to 9th graders fell from 14 to 10%. Lifetime heroin use among 16 to 18 years old fell from 2.5 to 1.8%. Not very big, but down after decriminalization. Isn't that interesting?
Yes. Our friends over in the Drug Policy Alliance, they specialize in, you know, reform of drug laws, and they are very big on promoting this decriminalization because it reduces drug use, just as you stated. It's not our specialization, but we are good friends and colleagues with all the other harm reduction organizations in the United States and worldwide. So we are very big supporters of the Drug Policy Alliance in their work because, you know, study after study shows that when you make drugs illegal, you create a black market. It becomes very profitable to sell drugs. So you create great increases in crime and increases in drug use. We saw this with alcohol prohibition in the United States, too. Great increases in crime. So the drug war just does not work.
Well, what could be done as far as regulations in the United States, for example, and alcohol, less, more? What would your opinion be there to help this whole situation with people overdoing alcohol?
I think that our laws with alcohol are quite reasonable, by and large. The one thing that I would really like to see changed legally is to make the breathalyzer ignition interlock a standard feature on cars, just like a seatbelt.
So really?
That, you know, if you are drinking, you cannot start the car. That would really reduce drunk driving greatly.
Really? Isn't that, that seems a little, I don't know, for a fellow like myself who hasn't drunk for about 30 years just because I don't want to, I don't know if I'd want to do that all the time. But you think it would be generally would be a good thing?
Well, you know, you could eliminate 99% of drunk driving. The only people that could do it would be the ones that would hotwire their car.
Yeah, and I
would
or get their friend to blow in the thing, right?
Yeah, and I would think that you would want rather severe punishments, severe penalties for, you know, overriding the interlock.
Mm-hmm.
But many people, I mean, we're not a political lobby group. We're a support group, so that we don't officially lobby for any laws, but we've discussed this in our online groups, and the majority of people in our group say that would be a great idea. That would be a great way to, you know, get rid of most of the drunken driving.
There's an old adage in business, Kenneth Anderson, that what gets measured gets done. What gets measured gets done in business. And I noticed on your site that your organization, Harm Reduction Network, you actually talk about charting one's drinking. It's so different from the idea of saying that drinking is bad, no, XX, the devil, evil, let's not ever do it anymore, then actually writing it down and saying, well, yeah, Tuesday I had this and that. Talk a little bit about the difference in energy there. I think that's fascinating.
Well, charting is an extremely effective way of changing your drinking behaviors. This has been studied in detail by Mark and Linda Sobel, also by Martha Sanchez Craig at the Addiction Research Foundation in Toronto. They found that when people started charting their drinks, even when they were not trying to make a change, the very fact of being so conscious of what they were doing helped them to cut down on the amount that they were drinking. I did the same thing when I was quitting cigarettes. I did take Chantix, which is an aid to quit, but I also charted my cigarettes and reduced from about 25 non-filter hand-rolled cigarettes every day to about 2 a day before I actually quit over a period of about 40 days.
And isn't that interesting? Over 40 mm-hmm. days, you went from 2 all the way down to 2, and then you quit.
I quit. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Do people, have you seen that kind of success with alcohol that quickly? If the goal is to be total abstinence, have you seen people go from being really in trouble to no drinking in your program in a short period of time?
Some people have changed quite quickly in, you know, a month or so. They've gotten their change down and they're successful with it. Some people take much longer. Some people, I mean, we are a program that can meet anyone where they are at with their change process. So if it's taking you a long time to change, we don't say, well, look at so-and-so, they changed right overnight, you need to do the same thing. No, we recognize there's individual differences. So some people can change quite quickly, some take a long time, and we also know there's the 20% we talked about that can go into the standard 12-step type program, and they change overnight. It's a quantum change, and it works for a certain percentage of people. So,
Hi, what's your first name? Where are you calling from?
My name's Barbara.
Barbara, speak up. You're on the air with Kenneth Anderson. Hi.
Okay, my name's Barbara. I'm from Little Rock, Arkansas, and I had a comment and a question.
Sure.
I'm a 57-year-old pretty heavy drinker, but for the last 10 years, I just decided, too, that I didn't need to be doing that to my body, and I pretty much, you know, just quit, and maybe once a year I might have a glass of wine. But recently I had a friend who had her 26-year-old daughter killed in a car accident by a drunk driver going the wrong way on the interstate. And I told my 19 and 21-year-old sons that I better never have to explain why they got so drunk and got in a car and did that to anybody else's child. And so I was just wondering if he thinks it's reasonable to keep a 19 and 21-year-old from ever picking up the drinking habit.
You mean to have it in your house rules of no drinking, you mean?
Right, or just discourage it to where that they really don't ever begin that habit like I did in high school and college and then carried on for 25 years.
What do you think, Kenneth?
Well, there's several issues here to address. One is when we talk about harm reduction, we recognize that harm is in a hierarchy, and some harms are worse than others. Drinking and driving is one of the riskiest behaviors that you can engage in. It's worse than just drinking by itself. So we try to encourage everyone, if they do plan to drink, to have a strategy where you don't have to drive. I mean, if you're in New York City like I am, it's much easier. You have the subway, public transportation, taxi cabs. There's no excuse for drinking and driving in New York City. Absolutely. If you're in a more isolated place, you need to find, have a designated driver or have some option where, you know, you can walk to where you're going to drink and walk back if you are going to drink. You know, it's better to train your children, you know, to, well, if you can encourage them not to drink at all, that might be a good thing. But if you get too punitive, you can actually, you know, have people rebel and say, well, I'm not going to do anything you say. I'm going to do the opposite.
And boy, that happens. Kenneth and Barbara both, this is interesting. It came up. We talked with a fellow, I think it was it yesterday? Or, well, one of those days. Monday. Actually, yesterday, John Van Alken from the Edgar Cayce Foundation. We were talking about raising kids and spirituality and stuff.
Right.
And he said that this was one thing that he had to put down. Excuse me. He had to lay down a rule in his house that they, as long as they never were allowed to drink and drive, and here's $40. Here's an envelope. You put this in your wallet, and if you ever get out there with your car and you drink, you take a cab home, and this is the rule.
That's,
you know, this is the rule. And he said it was so funny because they never had a problem, and just not long ago, his son, who was maybe 22 or 23 years old, showed up in a cab one night, and he had spent that money because he remembered that rule. Wow. I really thought that was interesting. I like that.
That is very interesting.
Isn't it kind of where, you know, it's not this dogmatic thing of, as Kenneth was saying, I think kids are going to rebel when you do that. Or often do they, Kenneth?
Well, in my case, both my parents were religious teetotalers, and all four of my grandparents were religious toddlers. They all said, if you drink alcohol, you will go to hell and burn in hell forever.
Hmm.
And the effect on me was to make me a big drinker because I didn't, you know, I didn't care for that attitude at all. And it took me a long time to actually come to the point where I became more sane with my drinking, because I was still rebelling, you know, against that when I was 40 years old.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the kind of the opposite's going on in my family. My cousin died of cirrhosis of the liver when he was in his early 40s, and his son actually killed himself and another man in a head-on collision when he was drunk. And so it's in my family really bad, mm-hmm. and I kind of decided I wanted to stop this cycle of it being in my family.
Yeah.
And well, is there any organization, like, I don't know if Mothers Against Drunk Driving is really, I know it's helpful, but if it's really working, I was wondering if there's anything like Mothers Against Drinking, you know, just because of the problems with driving and then with their own health.
Well, I will say one thing. I'm not sure about Mothers for Drunk Driving. I can't speak for them. There is research that also shows that when there is heavy drinking in the family, very often, say, the children of parents will rebel against that, and they'll say, I don't want to be a heavy drinker because
that's
I don't
what I've
want
done.
To be
Finally.
Like mm-hmm. X or Y. And so, you know, if your children see that as a bad example in their family, they might say, oh, I don't want to emulate that. What I really encourage most strongly is, you know, to educate them about the facts of, you know, that, you know, moderate to light drinking, it, you know, can be safe, you know, but you need to take precautions not mm-hmm. to drink and drive. Heavier drinking, the more you drink, the more problems that you can cause for yourself. Mm-hmm. And if you're very honest with your children and tell them the facts and don't, you know, try to scare them with big horror stories to make them never drink again, mm-hmm. I think that telling the truth and giving them the facts is the best approach you can take with your children. We also have a website called Students for Safe Drinking that
okay.
you can look up. It's collegedrinking.org,
okay.
and it has some information about safe drinking for younger people, because we okay. know, even, you know, that the drinking age is 21, well, some people drink when they're underage. They do need to be informed about what's safe and what's not safe.
Right.
Barbara,
right.
Another idea. Over the years of doing many shows on health and nutrition, mm-hmm. as we have here, many years, there definitely, in my opinion, which means nothing around here, but in my opinion, there's a definite correlation between blood sugar mm-hmm. and disruptive drinking problems, because mm-hmm. Alcohol is made, of course, from grains, which mm-hmm. is just loaded with sugar, and it's
right.
So there's also ways that you can really do some exploration and look at dietary things mm-hmm. for yourself and others. Mm-hmm. And these complex carbohydrates really mm-hmm. play havoc on
right.
the blood sugar. And, of course, Cokes and Pepsis and
yeah.
high fructose corn syrup, mm-hmm. but even bread and cookies, cakes, crackers, mm-hmm. and all of that, mm-hmm. that messes with the blood sugar. And getting the right foods, the right fats, coconut oil, and these kinds of things help to stabilize the blood sugar. And the cravings really, really go down. So there's a physiological component as well as a spiritual component.
Exactly. And so I'm just really glad to hear your guest today, because this is just something exactly what I was looking into and needing.
Well,
for two boys that are both going to be in college.
Yeah.
And I know that I fear, too, that even if, say, they're not drinking or they get in the car with a friend that has been, and so with the $40 in the pocket now, they can call a cab.
That's right,
if,
man.
Just, if they're not drunk.
Yeah, just do a cab. Just do a cab. All right, Barbara, thanks for calling
thank
from
you.
Little Rock. You live in a
all
beautiful
right.
place in the world.
Thanks very
you
much.
All getting any rain there?
No, we're not. We need it really, really bad.
Boy, us too, yeah. It's a pretty place. Thanks, Barbara.
Thank you.
Kenneth Anderson is with us. He is the CEO and founder of HAMS, Harm Reduction Network, author of How to Change Your Drinking, A Harm Reduction Guide to Alcohol. He's given a couple of websites. He'll give you those websites again, but the main one for his site is hamsnetwork.org, and I believe they have a 9 p.m. Eastern live chat. We'll confirm that after the break. Tomorrow, Dr. Murray Grossman, we're going to be talking about anxiety and cool things with allergies, digestion, and looking in the mirror and understanding how if you're freaking out. And also then Marty Gallagher, building muscles. He's actually been working with some of the Navy SEALs and stuff too. And this Marty knows about building muscles. That's tomorrow between 9 and 11 Central. And then open phone Friday. On Friday, my name is Patrick Timpone. We're live here every morning. It's July 20, 2011, about 27 minutes before the hour. If you'd like to be on the show, patrick@oneradionetwork.com is one way, patrick@oneradionetwork.com email. And live here this morning on Wednesday, July 20, you can call 888-663-6386. Daniel Vitalis, let's play a game. On a desert island, you can only pick one food. Just one. Just only one.
If I had to live off of one food, I think it would be, if I had any choice, it'd probably be colostrum. It's the most complete food that I know of. And the thing about colostrum is it's the first food for any mammal. So it's kind of a no-brainer that colostrum contains all essential fats, it contains all essential amino acids, it contains all essential glyconutrients, which are carbohydrates. It basically contains every substance that we need to maintain our bodies. The first milking you get from a cow after the cow calves is called colostrum. Every milking thereafter is called transitional milk. And what it is it's part colostrum and part milk. So that's something that can happen in the industry because people will sell you the transitional milk and call it colostrum. We're very careful not to do that. We only use the first milking of the animals.
Pure colostrum from SirThrival. They take the moisture out. That's it. To order, click on the picture of colostrum, front page, oneradionetwork.com. Boy, I'm so excited about this product. We've been eating it here at the Timpone household in Dripping Springs, Texas for, I guess, probably a year now. And it's really fun. You get this 2.2, the 1 kilo can, and it's like a never-ending bucket. It's like a loaves and fishes thing. And they take the moisture out. And that's all they do, as we said. And it's very light. And boy, when you get a net weight of 2.2 pounds, it's a lot of product. You can eat on it for a very, very long time. Seems like it never ends. And I just love to do tablespoons full during the day. Just boom, boom. Keeps my blood sugar happy. And it's such an amazing thing with growth factors. And it's really a fun food. And as Daniel said, if he had one, only one, he'd pick that one. And we really respect Daniel Vitalis. This is a great product. And you can look on it right on the front page, as we said, on oneradionetwork.com. Click on it. Any one of the survival, SirThrival links, obviously the colostrum link, but the one that says pine pollen or reishi mushroom, they all go to Daniel Vitalis, and he'll take you there. And that's how we support our efforts here on One Radio Network, is by offering you some cool products that we really love and can stand behind and really feel strongly about. Then we get some commission off of that, and that's how we pay the bills, and everything else is absolutely, totally, positively free on OneRadioNetwork.com.
Know the source.
The source.
OneRadioNetwork.com. Talk to Patrick now. 888-663-6386. Or email patrick@oneradionetwork.com.
Talking to Kenneth Anderson, founder, of Harm Reduction Network and author of the book, How to Change Your Drinking. Kenneth, again, give us a couple of those websites. So your main website is hamsnetwork.org, right?
That's correct. And we also have collegedrinking.org.
Collegedrinking.org. That's great. Collegedrinking.org. Okay.
And if you want to find out a little bit about our book, you can go to hamsnetwork.org/book, or you can look up the title on Amazon.
Oh, good. And we'll also put a link right to Amazon from your show page there so folks can order it. And I know it's strange. I mean, I don't drink, and I don't think it's pretty wise. I just like to get more aware, you know, more clear rather than fuzzy at all. But that's just me. But, you know, to be able to talk about this thing and even laugh about a collegedrinking.org that I just did off the cuff, for me, even though I don't, you know, I think it takes the energy off of this is bad stuff and this is evil. And once again, you're going to go to hell and blah, blah. And I it's been my experience, Kenneth and ladies and gentlemen, that when we judge things harshly, or we judge a person's behavior harshly, and then we expect them to change. It doesn't work. It doesn't work.
Well, as I said, I was brought up with this whole go to hell if you drink alcohol. And, you know, I was rebelling until I was in my 40s still against this and still being a heavy drinker and saying, no, I'm not going to be like you, my parents, that were, you know, against everything that was fun, against everything that was pleasurable. You know, I'm going to do just the opposite of everything you did. So, you know, and it's just been the last 10 years or so that, you know, I started realizing, you know, you can't let your parents still control your life at this age. You can make your own decisions. You don't have to rebel against everything they said. You can decide for yourself, you know, what is a reasonable amount of alcohol to drink and many other things in my life, too, you know. So I've calmed down a lot in the last 10 years, and, you know, it's in the last 4 years that it's January 2007. We founded this organization. And, I mean, I was working before that in this direction, but, you know, we launched in January 2007.
Mm-hmm. You know, Kenneth, go ahead.
So we've been around over 4 years now. I wanted to talk a little bit about our program here, our approach.
Okay.
We have 17 elements, and we call them elements and not steps, because the elements are all optional. And you can do them in any order. And some people find, you know, they only need to do one, and that will work for them. Others want to, you know, pick and choose several. If people, you know, can't decide where they want to start in the program, we say, well, okay, number one is a good place to start. The 17 are kind of in a default order if you can't figure out where to start. But if you find one that appeals to you a lot, some people will start by charting, and we were talking about that before. And just the act of charting itself can help them reduce. But the first element in our program is doing a cost-benefit analysis of your drinking habits. And this has been studied quite a bit. And it's pretty simple. It's a written exercise. You get out 4 sheets of paper. On the first, you write down the advantages of your current drinking habits, the way they are now. And on the second, you write down the disadvantages of your current drinking habits. And then for your change goal, say your change goal is quitting, you write down on the third sheet, what are the pros, the advantages of quitting completely? And then on the fourth sheet, what are the cons of quitting completely? And some people will say, you know, well, should I really write down the good things about drinking right now? Shouldn't I just write down the bad things? And actually, it's very important to be aware that there are benefits to drinking. You drink because it has a payoff. And if you try to just leave that in your subconscious and you don't recognize that as the reality, that will sneak up on people and, you know, they will relapse. They will start drinking at the worst times. So it's very important.
Isn't that interesting? So you've got to become, Kenneth, really squeaky clean with your analysis of yourself and admit that there is a payoff for some people because they get kind of buzzy and they feel good and or whatever, and that loosens them up or whatever the benefit is for them. So it's important to be aware of that.
Absolutely. You have to bring it all to consciousness. And the second reason why it's very important to recognize the advantages, for example, some people will say, I drink because it relaxes me. And then you can say to yourself, okay, how else can I find a way to relax that doesn't use alcohol? Can I do exercise? Can I do yoga? Can I do meditation? You know, can I go to a good movie? What can I do that will relax me and fulfill this positive thing that alcohol does for me that's a replacement? So, and, you know, sometimes some people drink because they have social phobia. It's hard for them to talk to other people. And maybe they will decide to join Toastmasters and practice talking in front of a crowd so they can get more relaxed talking with people. So when you recognize that the alcohol has advantages, you can find other ways to fulfill these positive things that are less harmful than drinking alcohol.
It's really interesting to that non-judgmental approach and even doing cost-benefit analysis. That's pretty cool.
Then in our second element, we ask people to choose a goal. Do they want to be a safer drinker? Do they want to reduce the amount they drink? Do they want to quit? Of course, you can be safer and reduce both at the same time. And after people make, you know, choose a goal, we ask them to start making a plan about how they're going to achieve their goal. But the cost-benefit analysis can be very helpful in helping people to decide what goal will be best for them. Do they want to be safer? Do they want to cut back? Or do they want to quit completely? And then number three, we talk about risks and ranking your risks. As I mentioned earlier, harm is in a hierarchy. Some harms are worse than others. Drinking and driving is probably worse than drinking and calling up your friends on the telephone. You might be embarrassed from that, but you won't kill anyone. So, you know, we ask people to recognize, you know, what the risks are. Some people do have a big problem with drinking and dialing because they'll get drunk and call up their boss and cuss out their boss. And in that case, it's much riskier than if you're just calling your friends. So if it's a really bad problem, you know, we might tell people, turn off your phone, lock it up in a safe where you can't access your phone. If you're going to drink, you know, make your plan ahead of time so that you don't engage in a risky behavior. We advise people always carry condoms with them. You know, if you pick up a stranger in a bar, you know, and you don't have a condom with you, you're intoxicated, you're very unlikely to decide to go out and get one. It's much safer to have one with you.
Yeah, it's the idea of looking at an issue or a problem clearly, objectively, without judging it. I would argue, in my life, I've seen that it wasn't until I could totally, absolutely love and forgive myself for a particular habit that I didn't like that was I able to let go of it. I know that's the case for me.
I think that's the case for everyone. We urge people to be very gentle with themselves. You know, change, for most people, change doesn't happen all at once. It happens in stages. When Prochaska, who wrote Changing for Good, when he studied smoking, he said 5% of people quit smoking on the first try. The other 95% take multiple tries. The average, it takes 4 to 5 times of attempting to quit smoking to succeed. So if you fail the first time, don't say, you know, oh, well, I'm a failure, I can't stop, so I'm just going to keep smoking. No, you just keep trying, and you don't beat yourself up. The more you beat yourself up, the harder you make it to change.
Here's an email from Denny to your guest. AA members know that an alcoholic doesn't undergo a quantum change overnight. They stop drinking overnight in order to begin the difficult task of deep spiritual transformation that will allow them not to drink again. The 12 steps, if followed diligently, will enable the alcoholic soul to learn to love themselves, accept others, and to recognize that they are totally responsible for everything they do and have ever done. This kind of work takes place over a lifetime. Most people are not willing to undergo this kind of change, so that the probability accounts for the relatively low success rate for AA and other 12 steps. It's not because AA doesn't work, it's because people don't want AA to work.
Once again, as I've said, I have many friends and colleagues who work in the harm reduction programs who are members of 12-step programs, and I totally respect their right to choose that method of change. And in fact, you know, it works for quite a number of people. And if it's working for you, if it's working for anyone, that's excellent. There have been studies that have shown that other approaches have higher success rates than the 12-step approach. When just given to a randomly selected group of people, Jeffrey Bransma in 1980 published a study called Outpatient Treatment of Alcoholism, where he had a randomized group of people. Some were assigned to a 12-step condition, some were assigned to a cognitive behavioral condition, some were assigned to a psychodynamic therapy condition, and others to a control group. And he found that actually, that with random assignment, the people assigned to the cognitive behavioral group and the psychodynamic group did better than the other groups. They did better than the 12-step group or the control group. Now, some 12-step programs appeal to some people. People who self-select them are likely to do well with them. This is something I support very strongly, is people should look at many things out there and select the approach that appeals to them, because probably they are selecting what is going to work best for them.
Sure. So they're attracted to what works best for them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. And my only experience with 12-step programs is what you see in the movies. And I was always, had a disconnect for me when I heard the people say that they don't have the power and blah, blah, blah. To me, spiritually, that's exactly opposite with my experience with spiritual law, that we as soul are the only ones who have the power. And when we give that power to anything else, nothing happens, because we are the ones that eventually stop doing this or doing that. We make a decision every fraction of a nanosecond of where we put our attention as soul. So that's been my experience.
Many people do say that they have a problem with the powerlessness. And that's why there are several other programs out there. There's a number of programs that are empowerment programs. Smart Recovery is a program that uses cognitive behavioral therapy. They're about quitting drinking completely. They don't do a harm reduction approach. But they're very much about empowering people to change instead of having them admit powerlessness. There's another Charlotte Castle, I think K-A-S-L is her last name, has a book about her 16-step empowerment approach. So there are alternative approaches to addictions that are based on empowerment rather than powerlessness.
Mm-hmm. You have a call. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Oh, I was just going to say, we are one of them. We incorporate harm reduction. Many of the others are about complete abstinence.
Mm-hmm. You have a 9 o'clock Eastern time call? 9 o'clock Eastern time call on your website?
Yes, our chat room.
I'm sorry, chat room, 9 p.m.
Yes.
Eastern?
That's correct.
And that's on, the website is hamsnetwork.org. Now,
yes.
It's not an oral thing, it's a chat where you're typing.
It's a typing chat.
Oh,
yes.
Cool. So how long have you been doing that?
The chat started in January of 2007. We launched the whole website everything then.
Do you have quite a few people that come in?
Yes, we do. We can get some very lively chats sometimes, get a dozen or so people, and we've had people from all over the world come in, from Australia, from Great Britain, Europe. Great Britain, it's like 3 a.m., but we still get people that pop in sometimes.
What are some of the experiences that you have heard or seen, read, with people going from the AA approach to this slow but still harm reduction approach, the differences in their experience? What was some things that clicked for them, like this, why this worked for them and the others did not?
Well, we do have some people that have left AA, and they said that they knew that they were going to drink again anyway, and they were happy to find, some tools to make it safe, because they knew that they didn't like the powerlessness, and they didn't believe. For example, some people have come in that are ex-heroin addicts. They never had a problem with alcohol in their life, but then they went into treatment and they were told, well, if you're addicted to heroin, you're addicted to everything, and you have to quit everything except you can smoke yourself to death with cigarettes and drink all the coffee you want, but all the other psychoactive substances you have to quit completely, including alcohol. And, they'd say, well, I never had a problem with alcohol. Why can't I control it? And they just would be given this very authoritarian thing of, we know everything, so you have to quit. But actually the research shows that there are many people that have kicked a heroin addiction that can become moderate social drinkers and not have a problem with it.
Mm-hmm. Are there a lot of people trying to cut down or stop alcohol that you've come in contact with that are also doing recreational drugs, marijuana, or whatever is out there these days, like ecstasy and those kind of things? And does that hinder the whole process?
probably I've met more marijuana users coming into my program. People that have used that tend to use the heavier drugs, there are drug harm reduction programs out there. Actually, let me back up a minute. Because actually we decided a while back to split up our email group. We have the alcohol email group and we have the drug users email group. Because the drug users actually said, well, we would feel more comfortable to have our own group. So it's not that we kicked them out and ostracized them, but they said that we would like to have our own, so we did. So we do have a drug users group, too, that you can get to from our harm reduction website. But there are also many other drugs harm reduction programs out there, such as the Harm Reduction Therapy Center in San Francisco, which is operated by my colleague, Pat Denning. I mentioned her book earlier in the show, Over the Influence. That's an excellent program where drug users have live meetings that they can go to, and they're very comfortable there, and it's done great work. There's also the Speed Project in San Francisco that's run by, well, one of the people that work there is my colleague, Terry Morris. She was interviewed on our internet radio show. We have one on Blog Talk Radio called Harm Reduction, Addiction Treatments That Work.
So this idea of non-judgmental, of almost like we do with cancer, is in a sense, this may be carrying it too far, but we talk about cancer, you have to, not have to, but if you love the cancer and you treat it as just a kind of a mix-up in the DNA and the cells, and not look at it as something evil that you have to kill, people, I believe, it's been my experience, that their bodies can heal the cancer. Does this idea then, this harm reduction, have you seen it work then with things like heroin and stuff?
Absolutely. Actually, as I said, I learned to do harm reduction by working in needle exchange. That is one way of using heroin more safely, is to use clean needles.
That's amazing when you think about it, isn't it? Something is deadly and weird. Or not weird. See, there I go. See, I just made a judgment against this stuff. And as long as you do that and treat somebody who's doing it as being really dumb or stupid, you know, it's not going to help them, is it?
That's correct. What we found is when people are too traumatized, when they're excessively traumatized, it makes it much harder for them to change their habit for the better or to quit a bad habit. People who do not contract HIV find it easier to quit heroin than people that have contracted AIDS, because, you know, some people who have contracted AIDS, they just say, well, everything's terrible now, I might as well give up. There's no reason to stop.
Yeah, I might as well just do drugs.
So the more harms that you can prevent, the better a chance you give the person to change. And most heroin users will quit eventually. It's like 12 years of, after 12 years of using, there's a strong tendency to quit. I mean, I think half the people quit after 12 years or something like that. I've seen those numbers. So the more trauma and the more horrible consequences that you can prevent, the better chance you give people of quitting eventually.
Sure, it seems to me, Kenneth Anderson, that it's a strong argument for decriminalization, even of things like heroin, and people could go and talk about it reasonably and, like you do, chart their usage and really look at it as a real health problem, a disease, spiritually, emotionally, physically, and deal with it holistically. Seems to be so much better than the way it's being dealt with now.
Oh, absolutely. In Switzerland and some other countries, they have tried heroin maintenance programs where you can come in and you can get your dose of heroin from the doctor. And they found that this greatly eliminated crime, or people didn't have to steal things to buy their drugs, so, because, you know, this was covered by the healthcare program. So it greatly eliminated crime. It got used syringes off the streets. It did everything. It really cleaned things up wonderfully in Switzerland when they introduced the heroin maintenance program.
Very interesting. What do you think about the medicinal marijuana issue? Do you have some comments on that in the short time we have available? Have you looked into that at all?
Yes, I've looked into that. And in fact, we have a chapter in the book, a section in the book, about medical marijuana as a substitute for alcohol use. There are some people who've had big problems with alcohol. They have liver damage that it's should not drink again. Well, marijuana does not harm the liver. Some people always get into fights in bars when they drink, but marijuana doesn't make people belligerent and doesn't cause fights. Some people have seizures and things from withdrawal when they drink alcohol, and they don't have those kinds of withdrawal syndromes from marijuana. So for a number of people, medical marijuana can be a better substitute than alcohol if they are having these severe problems when they drink alcohol.
We've done a couple of shows, and we'll do more. There's some pretty fascinating work going on with marijuana and cancer. There's a lot there to marijuana that we have no idea, I think, Kenneth Anderson.
There's a great deal of research, far more than I'm in touch with. I see a lot of it peripherally.
Mm-hmm.
I look most closely at the things that affect drinkers the most.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting work. I appreciate you you coming on the show. The main website that you'll find all the juice here from Kenneth Anderson and his organization, Harm Reduction Network, and his book, How to Change Your Drinking, is at HAMS Network, HAMSnetwork.org. Kenneth Anderson, thanks for hanging out with us this morning. We appreciate you, sir.
Thanks for having me as a guest.
Yeah, been a pleasure. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Okay, you little pumpkin pies, thanks for joining us here. We're live every morning. OneRadioNetwork.com. OneRadioNetwork.com. We have over 1,300 shows available worldwide, free of charge, to listen right there. Look into our past shows and archives, a little search engine, find out what you want. It's all on health, wealth, and well-being. I love you all very much. It's an honor for me to be here with you each day on OneRadioNetwork.com. My name is Patrick Timpone. You're doing the very best you can. See you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock Central Time.
Broadcasting from the beautiful Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.